This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. And here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So soldiers went on the rampage, got to the arsenals, got the guns, started shooting in the air, went out and cut off access to the camp to anyone happening to be in the vicinity of that place. And apparently they have now cut off the road between Kati and Bamako.
That was journalist Bram Posthumus on soldiers in Mali staging some kind of mutiny in the country's main military base. Details coming up also. The latest talks on the controversial Nile Dam are underway in another effort to resolve differences between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia. And Sudan's transitional government has signed a provisional peace deal with a leading rebel group. Those stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. There's been some kind of military mutiny at Mali's main military base located near the capital Bamako. Details are sketchy, but while soldiers have been firing in the air, there have been no reports of casualties so far. It's also unclear what sparked the unrest, but the country has been hit by months of protests demanding that the president resign, and attacks by jihadist groups have left many dead in Mali and elsewhere in the troubled Sahel region. Journalist Bram Posthumus, who normally reports from Bamako, spoke with International Edition's Steve Miller. Bram spoke from Amsterdam, where he is following the breaking developments.
A mutiny broke out earlier today at a main military camp in Kati, which is 10 miles outside to the north of Bamako and basically Mali's main garrison town. So soldiers went on the rampage, got to the arsenals, got the guns, started shooting in the air, went out and cut off access to the camp to anyone happening to be in the vicinity of that place. And apparently they have now cut off the road between Kati and Bamako, which is downhill. And actually that road from that main military camp in Kati into Bamako goes right past the presidential palace. So it is a sensitive area. That's what we know so far.
Has the fighting been limited to this garrison, or has it spilled out into the surrounding area?
No, it looks like the fighting has been contained and has been limited to the sprawling military camp. It's a big place. Kati is essentially a military town, but it hasn't spread beyond the perimeters of either the camp, and from what I know, it hasn't even spread into the town of Kati, let alone into Bamako.
We know there's gunfire, but have there been any confirmed reports of casualties?
No, none whatsoever. This seems to have not led to any human casualties so far.
There were some reports of abductions having taken place. Have those claims been substantiated?
No, there's conflicting information about that as well. There were rumors spread on Twitter especially that said that the Minister of Finance had been abducted, which was then countered by others on the same social media saying, no, he's under protection of at least the part of the army that's which is majority still loyal to the government in place of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. So, again, conflicting evidence, lots of speculations. I think what we should retain so far is that whatever action is actually going on right now has been limited to the town of Kati, whereas obviously in Bamako there is tension. The reaction is that people tend to stay at home. They don't go out. There have been rumors also spread to the effect that people have been told not to come back to work after lunch. But these are all still in the realm of speculation. There is no hard and fast confirmation of any of this.
This is coming after months of protests against the president asking for him to step down. Have there been any messages geared towards him?
Well, there is another message in French, an anonymous male voice circulating that claims that by 2 p.m. local time in Bamako, the president should have resigned. or else we're going to get you. It is absolutely not clear who that voice belongs to. It has been spread through, mainly through WhatsApp and through one or two social media. So again, this is something that seems to be designed to heighten tensions rather than to come to any solution. And the very latest is that youths have been reported together at the Independence Square where the demonstration have happened over the past months in support of the military. But how many there are, they seem to number in the hundreds rather than the much larger demonstrations that were organized by Imam Mahmoud Diko previously.
That was journalist Bram Posthumus speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. The latest talks on the controversial Nile Dam are underway in another effort to resolve differences between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia over the massive hydroelectric project. South Africa's International Relations Minister, Naledi Pandor, said all three countries have reaffirmed their commitment to the African Union-led trilateral negotiations. However, Egyptian experts expressed concern over the lack of progress regarding a binding agreement on filling and operating the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Popular pressure is mounting in Egypt to go back to the UN Security Council or even resort to a military option. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Hamdi Abdurrahman, professor of political science at Cairo University, about the two options.
The problem here is that Egypt and Sudan, they sent letters and complaints to the United Nations. And Ethiopia succeeded with the support of South Africa to withdraw the file at the claim of this is a technical issue. And that when you have a regional grouping like the AU, it is the first option. So now I think it will be a hard decision to go back to the United Nations. Number two, you can go under the United Nations Security Council according to either chapter six or chapter seven. If there is a threat to international security and peace, and if we have now a failed track of negotiation and a threat to regional security and peace in the Horn of Africa and Nile Basin, so I think it comes under the text of Chapter 6. But in United Nations Security Council, you have the five members. And you have the different agendas. One of the main obstacles is China and Russia. You are not going to have an easy decision or a clear position from the United Nations Security Council because they have these different agendas. China itself has a problem with its own neighbors. So it is not for her interest to bring such issues to the United Nations Security Council. So I don't count a lot on the Security Council on this issue.
There is a mounting popular pressure on Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to resort to a military action after a decade of failed talks. Would the failure of diplomacy and the popular pressure push him to do that?
In spite of the media, no single Egyptian official threatened with using a military option. And even President Sisi, when he was inspecting the military on the Western Front with Libya, he said very clearly, our army is the strongest army in the region, but we are not aggressors. We protect our national interests. But we are not causing any threat to any other country. So I rule out the military option because the cost is very high. You are destroying your reputation among Africa. And this is not leading to anything because the problem will stay there. But in my opinion, you need to fight in diplomacy to reconsider the negotiating setting. So what are the terms of reference? There are three important issues. The problem of the defining term. We need a binding legal deal, not generous guidelines from Ethiopia. Number two, when you have droughts for many years, how to compensate the flow of water coming to Egypt and Sudan? This is a major issue in the negotiation now. The third issue is arbitration mechanism in the future, how to solve any dispute among the three nations. The last one, which is now a major problem in Ethiopia because it reflects the issue of sovereignty, is the future in the post-GERD era, because Ethiopia is thinking about building more dams. So is this negotiation will cover the future dams in Ethiopia? So if you come to reconcile and compromise on these issues, I think we will find a fair deal. So we have more time to reach a comprehensive deal in the coming year. If the three countries leave behind these nationalistic discourse and sensitive national interests, and to come in the middle by highlighting the interest and the rational choice approach for the sake of the whole region, and to make GERD a regional project rather than a nationalistic project for Ethiopia.
That was Hamdi Abdelrahman, professor of political science at Cairo University, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Sudan's transitional government has signed a provisional peace deal with a leading rebel group. According to the French news agency AFP, the government, which took power after the army overthrew longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir last year, has been holding talks in neighboring South Sudan since last October. The transitional government has made peacemaking with the SPLMN and other rebel factions based in Sudan's vast western region of Darfur one of its priorities. AFP says the 50-page document signed yesterday in the South Sudan capital Juba says the two parties have agreed on arrangements for the integration, disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of the SPLMN fighters. Meanwhile, heavy rains and floods have affected 220,000 people in 17 of Sudan's 18 states. The UN says more than 20,000 houses have been destroyed and another 20,000 more have been damaged. Some 2,000 water sources have been contaminated, compromising access to clean water in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. The UN and partners are appealing for $1.6 billion to provide crucial aid in Sudan this year, but only 43% of the appeal has been received. Police questioned former Mauritanian President Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz yesterday over financial dealings during his decade in power. He left the office last year, Nicolas Pinot reports for VOA in Paris.
The investigators wanted to question the former head of state about major suspicions of maladministration and embezzlement of public assets during his tenure between 2008 and 2019. Then Mohamedou Cheikh El Ghazouani, his former right-hand man and ex-defense minister, won the elections last year. In January, Parliament set up a commission of inquiry into Abdelaziz's affairs and formally handed its report to prosecutors this month. It was followed on August 9th by a government reshuffle that turfed out several former ministers whose names surfaced in the investigation. Among the issues probed by the commission were the handling of oil revenue, the sale of a state property in the capital Nouakchott. Aziz failed to answer a call to testify before the commission in early July. Within weeks, MPs approved a law to set up a High Court of Justice that would be empowered to try presidents and ministers in case of high treason. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says thousands of people have been affected by inter-ethnic conflict in the South Kivu Highlands of the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Mavis Ocheri in Ghana has more.
UNICEF says it is providing vital assistance to 40,000 displaced people who have fled violence around Makindye. Jibril Issa is the chief of the field office for South Kivu. He says among the displaced are 7,500 children under 5 and more than 1,500 pregnant women who have fled villages in the territories of Uvira, Fizi, and Mawinga due to intensifying ethnic conflict that have wiped away the livelihoods of thousands of people. He says that thousands of people in South Kivu's highlands are in dire need of food, shelter, health and education assistance, and call on humanitarian partners to step up their response in the area.
Actually, the security is worse because the conflict continues around Mikenge and Bujumbura.
Despite the problem of accessibility in this area, strengthening of humanitarian response is necessary in the high plateau of Sud-Kivu. It is for this reason I pled for a substantial mobilization of resources for this part of DRC.
He says 28 schools in Makindye have been looted or destroyed, and almost 80% of schools in Bijombo have been looted or destroyed. Issa says 10 health centers in Makindye were destroyed, including the Makindye Hospital.
All textbooks of these are lost, and most of school teachers have fled to Uvira due to this clash and insecurity. We have already reopened Mikenge Hospital and Free Health Center, and we organize a mobile clinic to those health centers accessible but far from Mikenge Center.
He says UNICEF is providing basic medical and vaccination services to around 23,000 displaced people taking shelter in Mount Mitumba. Issa says his organization is working to reunite or place in host communities children who have been separated from their parents. UNICEF also has distributed 2 recreational kits for team activities for up to 300 children in Makindye and Bijombo. He says UNICEF and its partners intend to distribute 4 tons of emergency food rations to 4,000 vulnerable people, as well as 200 workbooks to out-of-school children in the area. He says UNICEF is appealing for $301 million for the DRC, but still needs $219 million to reach that goal. Reporting for VOA, this is Mary Sotri in Ghana.
The ongoing closure of schools in Kenya due to the spread of COVID-19 pandemic has become a major source of concern and uncertainty among students, teachers, and parents. Kenyan authorities dashed hopes of many when officials announced recently that schools, universities, and other learning institutions won't reopen until next year. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
Kenyan officials say most learning institutions are not prepared to reopen as cases of the global pandemic continue to rise. Wandia Njoya is an education expert and a senior lecturer at Daystar University.
The problem with the Kenyan situation is that we refuse to build infrastructure for schools, and over the years we have been failing about 80% of our children, and that has not been an issue because we've been glorifying the few who pass. So now COVID has forced us to reckon with the fact that we are dealing with a dysfunctional education system. So I wasn't surprised, really.
The decision to reopen learning institutions in January means all students will be required to repeat their current classes then. While some students have been taking virtual classes, many worry about the future, as student Dorcas Chepkirui explains.
In my case, I have online lessons. There is a minimum support from the people around me, and there's also no physical contact with my fellow students to share the struggles with. So it's very frustrating being introduced to new units and subjects that you've never encountered before on your own. It's really frustrating.
Learning institutions in Kenya were ordered closed on March 15th as COVID-19 spread quickly. Professor George Magoha is Kenya's education secretary.
Should conditions change according to advice from health, then something else may happen. But nevertheless, the government is in the process of inspecting all schools and ensuring that those schools are capable of complying with their COVID-19 regulations. There's no apologies for locking up schools in order to safeguard the children of Kenya.
He says the government is considering some $65 million in concessionary loans to private schools to cushion them from the effect of the pandemic. Private school owners have been lobbying for government support to help sustain their schools and pay teachers. The Education Ministry is supporting public schools and their teachers, but many teachers in private schools have had to turn to other jobs to eke out a living. Njoya says the education system that demands students complete the syllabus while at home is not practical.
I would have preferred to see something like more reading, creative activities, so that you're keeping kids occupied with creative activities and building their language and communication skills, so that when you come back in January, it's faster for the kids to catch up because they are relaxed now and they can think better.
Kenya has registered over 30,000 COVID-19 infections with more than 480 deaths. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The hashtag Jerusalema Dance Challenge has taken social media by storm. Groups of people from Angola to Italy have posted videos of themselves dancing in sync to the Zulu song Jerusalema. From Cape Town, reporter Vicky Stark chatted with the vocalist who's also responsible for the lyrics.
34-year-old Nomcebo Zikode says God has answered her prayers for the world to hear her sing. The mother of two says she was called by South African musician and producer Master KG last year. He told her he had beats to match her soulful voice. Zikode says she was of two minds about going to the studio immediately, thinking she should perhaps work on the lyrics at home first. But eventually she agreed and went in to record.
The very same day when Master Kinchi called me, it was around 10, 11, if I'm not mistaken, at night. We recorded the song. I think he played the song for me 2 to 3 times. And I stood up. I told him to put me on the mic, my cans. I was like, Jerusalema, ikayalami, gilondoloze, uhambe nami, zuna ngishilana, gilondoloze, gilondoloze. And the rest was history.
Zikode explains what the song means.
The way I see it, I could see that this is God's work. God was trying to say something, because if you listen to the song, it says, Jerusalem, ikayalam, Jerusalem, my home, go with me, never leave me here, my wealth is not here, go with me to Jerusalem, where I will find happiness, where there is peace. So, in all, I think the beat find me, my heart was not at peace. I know I was praying so much, my music was not going right. I was spending so many days at home, not working, because my only work is music, I don't have anything else.
As a girl, Zikode loved singing so much that her neighbors sometimes had to tell her to be quiet. After high school, she didn't have money to follow her passion and study music, but she started going for auditions and landed gigs as a backup singer for several gospel stars, such as the late Lundi Taimara.
I then joined Afropop. I joined Mafiki Zolo. Also, I did backings for Zahara. She's also very big here in South Africa.
Zikode says being a backup singer for over 15 years taught her a lot and gave her the experience to do a song like Jerusalema, which has had over 50 million views on YouTube. But Zikode says she doesn't know who started the popular hashtag Jerusalema Dance Challenge.
I know the dance is from here in South Africa, but there are people from, I don't know whether Ghana or Kenya, where they started the dance with plates, with food in their hands. So that dance just went viral like nobody's business. As you can see now, we see people from Germany, London, America, Nigeria, everyone is now doing the dance. And I would love to, together with Master Katie, would love to say thank you, thank you, thank you so much to whoever who played a role of this music to become this big.
The singer says she can't wait for the end of coronavirus lockdown so they can perform live for audiences. She's also looking forward to dropping some new music. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.